So welcome to the King's Health Partners Haematology Primary Care podcast series called the KHP Heme Pulse. So my name is Dr. Cheryl Leung. I'm a GP in Southeast London and one of the two primary care clinical leads for pathology in the patch. So today we have a podcast focusing on the sickle cell disease, and I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. Sabana Chakraborty, who's a consultant haematologist for pediatrics at King's College Hospital. So she's kindly joined me today, and we have some common queries for primary care colleagues around sickle cell disease. So thank you very much, Sabana, for being here.
Oh, thank you, Cheryl, for having me. It's a really good pleasure to be here. Thank you.
So thank you, and I will start right away with a series of questions that we have. So the first one is, most patients with sickle cell seem to be of Afro-Caribbean origin. Are there any other groups of patients which we should also be aware of, which, albeit being less common than this group?
Yes, so sickle cell disease can be found in patients from patients who are not from Afro-Caribbean origin. So there are sickle cell in populations from around the Mediterranean. So southern Italy, you know, there's Portuguese, Turkish, North African, you know, who look Mediterranean essentially, you know, and of course the Middle East, and many, many, many Indians from the sort of center of the country. So the tribal belt of Middle India. So yes, so sickle cell disease does not only happen to you know, to patients from the Afro-Caribbean background, although that is the kind of patient group that we mostly see in London. But having said that, there will be others, and some who look, you know, very unlike, you know, who have very pale skin, but for instance, but might then have sickle cell disease.
That's really useful to know, because I think for medical students days, you learn about the very particular demographic of patients. So knowing that there are actually other patients around that we commonly have within the patch is really helpful too. So thank you for the pointers. The next question I've got is, in general practice, we often get blood results, for example, with slightly low hemoglobin and or a microcytic hyperchromic picture on the full blood counts. What do we do with these patients if they do or don't have any other risk factors? So specifically, do we need to refer them to hematology or do we refer them to genetics?
So in this case, I'm presuming that what you're worried about is wanting to exclude a significant hemoglobinopathy. So I'm presuming that you have excluded iron deficiency or any other, you know, they are not sort of topmost in your mind. Mm-hmm. If they, and when you say that, you know, they are have certain risk factors, I imagine, say, for instance, if there is a patient who has microcytic hyperchromic indices, mild anemia, not iron deficient, fairly young person, hails from sort of the Far East or maybe the Indian subcontinent, then mm-hmm. you're possibly thinking that this could be some form of thalassemia. Yes. In that case, I think it's in terms of referring, I would definitely, you know, you could refer to hematology. I don't think you necessarily need to refer to genetics, particularly in the context of mild anemia in the background of hyperchromia microcytosis, where every other cause has been excluded. Mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. the other option would simply to yourself, if possible, exclude beta thalassemia trait, which can be done with a simple hemoglobin electrophoresis. And you get a report back, which will say that the hemoglobin A2 is raised. And then they would say something in the region of, consistent with the diagnosis of beta thalassemia trait. In that case, it's fairly sort of straightforward to say, well, this patient or this person is hyperchromic microcytic indices because they've got beta thal trait. When it gets a little bit more complicated is when there is alpha thalassemia trait, where it's harder to, there is no straightforward, simple protein-based test that you can do. It needs a genetic test. And I don't think you will be able to test that from your surgery. I don't think that's kind of available for your kind of test repertoire. In that situation, I think it's probably best to refer to heme rather than to genetics. Now, there are some people from African origin, sub-Saharan Africa, that also have alpha thalassemia trait. But the type of alpha thalassemia trait that African origin people have is kind of, less clinical consequence, if you like, right, on its own,
yes.
than people who are from the Far East, in the sense that if they have alpha zero thalassemia trait, that generally people from the Far East tend to get, then there is higher risk of them having children with significant alpha thalassemia disease, either hemoglobin H disease or alpha thalassemia major, which is, you know, non-compatible with life. So, you know, there are significant consequences of somebody having alpha thalassemia trait, particularly if they're from the Far East. So in that situation, I think, you know, it's fairly justified to send them along, particularly if it's a sort of a young woman with, or man of childbearing age who really needs that sorting out.
Okay, that's helpful to know, because there are different traits, as we know, in terms of this condition and the scope of this condition. So I think it's often that we get full blood count results commonly like that, but just knowing what to be looking, what we should be looking out for as well, is really helpful. And I guess that brings me to the next questions, is that you kind of alluded to it earlier on, is how do we manage people who may have different traits? For example, is there monitoring that we should be doing? So for me personally, I know I have the beta trait, but it doesn't affect me at all. And I'm not on any treatment, but I just wonder how would it work for other people who may have different traits in terms of the blood counts?
Yeah. So I think, as you rightly say, anybody with a trait, or any kind of hemoglobinopathy trait, is actually generally tend to be completely asymptomatic. They do not need any treatment at all. Mm-hmm. What can get in the way is because the person who has a form of beta thalassemia trait will have microcytic hyperchromic indices, which can sometimes get confused for iron deficiency. And you may be tempted to treat somebody with iron just by looking at the red cell indices and not their ferritin. Given that it's fairly rare to have patients with, within the population, it's not a common thing to have. And therefore, you know, that is something that you need to avoid, particularly if it's a patient who comes from, I'd say, the Indian subcontinent or the Far East, any country where there is more likelihood of, particularly of thalassemias, and that would include the Mediterranean, it might be worth, checking their ferritin before starting iron treatment, unless there is, completely, there's significant history and so on, and you really need to start treatment soon rather than later. Ferritin is obviously very helpful in assessing iron, and the problem with beta thalassemia trait, if people on beta thalassemia trait keep taking iron, then they tend to have iron they tend to absorb iron quite readily from the gut, so you might end up with iron kind of accumulation that you don't really need. And the only other thing to say is that with these patients who have trait, the only thing that they need to bear in mind is for future generations. So if they are they have children with partners who also have trait, then it's of course there is a risk that the child will have a significant condition.
So I guess that would be an indication to say, actually, if we come across patients who have a trait of some sort, and if they're thinking about getting pregnant, is the preconception advice and counselling, that's also very key, even on doing pill checks that we do in general practice a lot. So actually having that in the back of your mind and be able to talk to patients about the importance of good preconception counselling is very key.
Absolutely agree with that.
Okay, that's helpful, because I think this is something that has been talked about quite a lot in terms of other conditions as well, where preconception counselling is really important. So I guess that's one of the big home take-home message for me as well. So thank you for that pointer. In terms of the going back to the monitoring then, is there a particular monitoring that we need to be doing, annual FBCs, full blood counts, or actually we don't have to worry too much about it if a patient has got a minor trait and it's asymptomatic?
No, I don't think they need any follow-up, any monitoring at all. I think it's good to know that they have got it, that's in their records. And as you say, it'll be good to kind of them to bring that to you at the time when they're thinking of having children of their own, et cetera, so that preconception side of things. But other than that, there is no monitoring needed.
I think that's really helpful, because often we're left wondering what should we do, should we do a full blood count 12 months or whatever. So that's good to know. The last question, I think it's more generically about sickle cell as a whole. Probably a million-pound question. What do you think the catches are that we should be mindful of in primary care or general practice, if there are any?
I mean, I think one thing that I'm a pediatric hematologist, so my majority of the care I do is for children with sickle cell disease. So one thing that is hugely helpful in terms of support are two things, really. One is that children need to be on penicillin. And in fact, we recommend that people need to be on penicillin for life. And often we find that there is, there might be the parents perceive that there is a little bit of difficulty in getting their prescription refilled or getting, sometimes I've heard that families are being only provided with 4 weeks worth of, follow-up prescription for penicillin, something that they are meant to be on for life. And it becomes harder for the family. So I think, on one hand, we're trying to tell them, you can do these online app-based requests and, whatever works for you between you and your pharmacy. So it might just be worth thinking whether it is easier or it might be helpful for the families to have, longer prescription episodes, and there are some fixed doses, which obviously we kind of recommend from the hospital. So under ones get 62.5 milligrams BD, over ones between 1 to 5 is 125 milligrams, and over five is 250 milligrams BD. So that's kind of a standard dose.
Right.
The other catch, I think, that's something that we have seen in terms of. The other thing I was thinking about is, if a patient has a symptom, which you may think might not be related to sickle. So for instance, if they've got, I don't know, I can't think of anything right now, but something that you might think that is not related to sickle, it might be worth just raising it with the sickle team to say, because almost everything that a sickle patient has is related to sickle. So if they've got some sort of a hip pain, rather than the referral going from the surgery to the orthopedic surgeon, it might be worth coming from the sickle clinic because, there may be preoperative, things that we need to do, and so on, and gynae operations and so on. So often what happens is that there is that miscommunication between the operating team and the sickle team because we've not really been in the loop, if you like.
Yes.
That's just one other thing. And the other thing about children, very common, is heart murmurs in babies with sickle cell.
Yes.
And often that's just because of their anemia. So often they end up being referred to cardiology and so on. So it's just really kind of closing in the loop of, could you please see to this thing that we've noticed? Or, if you do come across your, some symptom, it might be worth just checking or informing the consultant or the team, because almost everything is related to their sickle cell.
So I guess, just to sum that up, it would be ensuring that the patients get the prophylactic medication on time. And I guess that also brings to the point about them requesting it in time as well.
Exactly.
And then the second thing is about ensuring the hematology team is cited if they have an issue, because any symptom can be attributed to sickle, as we know, because it's a systemic disease effectively. And finally, I guess it's about communicating with your team, and no over communication is in excess if we're worried about sickle, without with the risk of hopefully not overloading you. But everything could be related to this condition. I hope that is about the right summary from the last question that we talked about in terms of catches in primary care.
Yes. I mean, it's so good to be able to kind of have that communication, two-way communication going. And I don't think you can over concern or overfill our inboxes with
okay. Well, that's good to know. That's good to know, because it's not often that we are writing to the hospital all the time. We try to manage as much as we can, as you know, in primary care. So that's all my questions for today, really. So thank you so much, Saberna, for sharing your expertise with us. And we hope all of you listening have learned something new along with us today, and certainly have every day to school day. Do spread the word with your colleagues by spreading the podcast link, and we are going to be really grateful for any any feedback that you have, if you could complete the poll and let us know your thoughts, any unanswered questions on the topic, and do let us know if you have any other topics that you would like us to focus on in the future episodes. So very much looking forward to developing this Haematology Primary Care podcast series with you, with your input, and do let us know if you'd like to be involved in the future episodes.
Thank you very much.